Hey, listeners, have you ever had patients give you an earful for using plastic pill bottles? Introducing Parcel Health's PhilBox. The PhilBox is fully biodegradable, water-resistant, and user-friendly eco-packaging for pharmacies. As pharmacists, we know containers aren't just containers. They're protectors of meds and displayers of med info. But they also are your pharmacy's daily mini billboard in a patient's home in their hands. So check out the PhilBox, see how it can fulfill your sustainability and marketing goals. Visit parcelhealth.co today and enter the keyword BizPharm with a Z for 10% off your order. Welcome to the Business of Pharmacy podcast, where we explore the business of pharmacy through candid, in-depth conversations with the industry's top leaders. Every Monday, tune in for insights and stories you won't find anywhere else. I'm your host, Mike Kelzer. Greg, for those that haven't come across you online, introduce yourself and tell our listeners what we're talking about today.
My name is Greg Reibold, and I'm General Counsel and Vice President of Healthcare Policy with American Pharmacy Cooperative. Much of my work focuses on PBM reform throughout the country at the state level as well as the federal level, and thrilled to be here to be talking about that very subject today.
Greg, your last job was in Georgia, and now you're more federal by the sake of your job. Did you ever get your hand slapped when you were in Georgia and you wanted to get more into the federal law and they said, well, Greg, that's not our responsibility right now? How does it feel going from state to federal organization?
Yeah, so being a part of the Georgia Pharmacy Association, certainly the bulk of my focus was on state legislative advocacy, regulatory advocacy, and agency advocacy. But state associations certainly offer input in connection with federal initiatives as well. And we do the occasional fly-in and things like that. But with American Pharmacy Cooperative, APCI, as we call it, have had the opportunity to really get more involved at the federal level. And it's been fun, but certainly different. At the state level, depending on what state you're in, 40 days. Georgia's 40 legislative days. And you can, within 40 days, boom, sweeping changes. The federal level, it just moves at a much, much slower pace.
When you say 40 days, you mean that's how long they're in session or that's how long it takes? What do you mean by the 40 part of that?
Yeah, so exactly. In Georgia, and a lot of states are similar with slight differences, but in Georgia, there are 40 legislative days. And those aren't necessarily calendar days, but they're in session for 40 days.
So on average, it's like a 1 day a week job. It's like you might have a job as a something else, a plumber, and then you come basically for a day a week on average.
So if you're looking at averages, yes. So in Georgia, what happens is usually the second week of January, they convene, and then they usually run it through the end of March or sometimes into April. And they fit those 40 legislative days into that period. But there's a lot of state representatives and senators who do have full-time jobs. And so it's in certain ways a sacrifice because they're stepping away from oftentimes their jobs, their careers, sometimes family for days or weeks on end.
Is that just a once a year crack then at getting this done? And what happens if something surfaces in May, something needs a vote or so on? Do they just wait till January?
Yeah, almost always. There are certain circumstances where the General Assembly at the governor's instruction can convene a special session. But for the most part, that's your window in Georgia. And a lot of states follow very similar suit. Some states do it a little bit differently, and they're in more throughout the year. But again, at the state level, you can see reform, pick your subject, happen really quickly. Federal is just a different ballgame. One of the biggest differences to me is in a state general assembly, it's really easy to talk with the state representative, the senator, and you can engage with them, and there's easy to access with them. And if you go up to the federal level, what's really different is it's very much staff and committee driven. And so rarely will you be talking with, you know, the congressperson themselves. Often you're working with their staffers or the committee staffers. There can be advantages and disadvantages. One of the advantages to that is a lot of these staffers get to be legitimate subject matter experts. standards. And so if you're working with a committee that's heavy on health or prescription drugs, a lot of these staffers, they know their stuff. That can be really refreshing. Of course, it's also nice at times to be able to have access to and sway the congresspeople themselves. So pros and cons.
Yeah, I guess when you say the staffers know a lot, something that comes to my mind is, are they already swayed? Because if you get maybe a state rep or something, it's like you have to kind of teach them this. And if you get their ear, you can sort of mold it a little bit into we hate PBM kind of angle. But the federal ones, since they know it so deep, I wonder if they already have some leaning one way or the other, just because they've heard from tens of dozens of hundreds of people on the subject already.
I think that's an insightful comment. And I think the answer is yes. Certainly, you can walk into that from time to time. There may be a staffer who left one committee and goes to another, or left one congressional office and goes to work on a committee. And certainly, they have had hundreds, if not sometimes thousands, of conversations on a particular subject. Certainly not all staffers. There are staffers who don't know a lot about prescription drugs or don't know a lot about drug policy or healthcare. But I have been surprised at sort of the level of nuance that some of these staffers do have.
All right, Greg, let's start all the way from the other end. And we've heard this a lot from different groups when they say talk to the legislators and so on. This advice we've heard over and over again is, you should only be talking to them about what's affecting their constituents. Because I know cliche from pharmacy, you call and say, you know, I'm going to lose my store that I've had forever. Is that true? Is that the angle you have to take, that basically every argument has to come back to how it's affecting the average pharmacy customer?
So I've been saying this a lot lately, and I'm going to say it again, but advocacy is, in many ways, art, not science. Right? There's certainly tried and true methods that you can stick to. But what I would say is, and this is something that I've had a lot of conversations about lately and something we've heard a lot of what we do is patient-focused, how this is going to impact patients. But it's also fair game to talk about how it impacts you as a pharmacist and you as a pharmacy owner. And it's absolutely relevant, and it's absolutely fair game. Now, whether the tact is, hey, my pharmacy is going to close in 4 weeks, 6 weeks, a year, I can't say. But what I can tell you is a lot of the folks up in Congress are business people. They are owners of businesses. And I have found that they are often fascinated when they find out that many times pharmacists are dispensing prescription drugs at a loss. If you're in any other business, it's almost unbelievable. What other business do folks provide a service and then lose money on that service? And so it's 100% fair game for a pharmacist to share those experiences, how it impacts them as a business owner, how it impacts them as an employer, how it impacts them as a healthcare provider, and how it impacts the care that they provide to the patients. I think that's all fair game.
Greg, when you go from something smaller to something bigger, some could argue that you had more power being a bigger fish in a smaller pond. And some can argue the other way, that yes, you are a smaller fish in a bigger pond, but if you get everybody else in the bigger pond to go a certain way, you can have more power that way. So far, what you've seen between state and federal, what has been your personal feeling of gratification that you've moved some minds and so on? Do you have a feeling of that, of state versus federal in your position?
I do. And I don't know that it's personal, but as an attorney and as an advocate for pharmacy, I think you look at it as, hey, are we effectively advocating? Are we shaping the industry in a positive way? Are we shaping change? And when you're at the state level and you're doing your job the right way and conditions are right, you are in a position where, you know, you can be one of the ones in the room when the decisions are getting made. You can have tremendous shape on not only your state, but then what happens at the national level. I was very proud when I was with GPHA. We worked on one of the first bills in the nation, Pharmacy Patient Protection Act in 2017. And it was written first of its kind. Instead of looking at very myopic, hey, we're going to go after MAC pricing or audits, it came in and it said, hey, PBMs, there's a list of things that you can't do. And it was innovative at the time. And it was really, I think, satisfying to see that the Georgia Pharmacy Association passed that legislation and then watch it grow and move into other states and become model legislation. And in certain cases, improve and get better. That was really neat to see. Similar in 2019, first PBM steering law in the country that got passed. And fast forward now to 2024, right? What year? Where are we? 2024.
You're lucky you're in the right decade.
But it's something where it's been passed in a lot of states, and you're seeing that concept also introduced at the federal level. So really satisfying to see that. But what I would say is at the state level, when you're doing your job right, it's a lot easier to put your hand on it and to shape it and hopefully be in the room when decisions that impact pharmacists are being made. When you get to the federal level, it can be a little bit of a different game. Again, you're not seeing bills pass one after the other, year after year. So it may be getting the right questions asked at a hearing, getting some draft language changed, close loopholes. And I feel like we've been very successful with a lot of that. And so you always try to look at, are we playing the game at the highest level that it can be played? Are we shaping policy? Are we shaping conversation? Are we shaping the way these things are viewed? And while it's measured differently, I think, at the state to federal level, you can absolutely influence both.
I one time talked to a county rep, and she said, I don't want to go higher than this. I want to talk to these kind of people. I want to talk to neighbors. I want to do this. I want to do that. So there's some love at certain levels. Do you have anything good to say about the feds moving at a slower speed than the states? Or do you think it's just all red tape and gobbledygook? Is there a reason for that slowness? I once heard that, I don't know who the hell it was, but they said that on purpose, government is made slow so everybody can take a look at it and things like that. A lot of times from an outsider, it seems too slow. What are your thoughts on the efficiency of the federal system?
Yeah, look, I don't think it's necessarily efficient, but is there a method to the madness? There very well might be. People who think, hey, we already have enough laws. Do we want to make it easier for folks to pass law after law? And I don't know, maybe not. What I would say is when you're in a field like pharmacy and you're trying to affect change and you're trying to bring relief to community pharmacists and their patients, I sure would like to see it move faster.
We haven't attacked the meat in the middle, but another question on the end of this. Michigan came out with a bunch of PBM laws on January 1st, 2024. And it seems like none of them have changed. And then I read something about how if you have a contract, some PBMs can not do something until 2028 and so on. How does that work with contract things? So you're in a contract with a PBM. The law changes on January 1st. When is the expectation that pharmacies or whoever is a part of the law would see things moving in correspondence with the law?
Yeah. It's a really good question. And I'll give you a couple different answers, some of them more cynical than others, okay? But some of it really does depend on how a bill is drafted and how a law is drafted. And so, for example, if a law says, hey, effective January 2025, a PBM cannot do A, B, C, D, E, F, and G, you're going to expect that to take effect and hopefully see some immediate impact. Fair enough. But a lot of these laws get drafted in ways where it says for contracts entered into on or after. And anything that you can create some wiggle room, PBMs are going to run with that as far as they can possibly run. And so is a new provider manual update, new contract? Their position is going to be no. And a lot of these contracts, if not evergreen, go on, and PBM just has the ability to go in and amend those via unilateral contract amendments or via provider manuals, but the contract lives on. And so wording becomes really important. On top of that, there's all sorts of other angles there. And so obviously we saw Rutledge v. PCMA was a great victory for pharmacy in a lot of ways. But in connection with networks and some steering angles, what we see is already a split in the circuit between the Eighth Circuit and the Fifth Circuit. And so if you're a large PBM, what are they going to do? They're going to construe the Supreme Court holding as narrowly as possible, look for any split in the circuits, and they look for arguments and ways to not adhere to certain state laws. And so what we find is, even in states with really strong state laws, PBMs pushing the envelope. And so on certain lower-hanging fruit laws, hey, no admin fees or no copay clawbacks or adhere to the Audit Bill of Rights, what you're going to find is, hopefully, pretty good enforcement, pretty good adherence. But when you start hitting that live nerve, Mike, and you start touching massive amounts of money, I mean, make-believe money, things like steering and rebate practices, things like that, they are going to find every way they can to not adhere to those new laws, new regulations, et cetera.
Yeah, and I suppose that to make it look good, they're going to take the low-hanging fruit, change those as quickly as they can to maybe show a good faith gesture, which in fact is just a way to keep people away from the door so they can keep the shenanigans going on in the back room.
Yeah, don't disagree. And I hate to compliment them, but they have, I would say, perfected not adhering to state laws and regs almost to the point of art. And again, I say that half kiddingly, half not, because I think I was working with my wife about this a couple of weeks ago. And it was like a lifetime of fighting pharmacy benefit managers. And sometimes it feels like we lose. And I think my great fear is lying on my deathbed, hopefully many years from now, and the doctor prescribes me something. Oh, it's a prior authorization. Sorry, you can't get it. Boom. I die in a fit of rage. Like,
and then they'll play the, what's the show with Larry David? They'll play that music of the,
Curb. Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yeah, I forget what the song is. But so even the easy laws, they may not even do the 1st of January. I mean, they maybe don't flip a switch. They might even still be doing some things that just haven't come about yet, I suppose.
Yeah, there are sometimes a ramp-up period or an implementation period, and I'm not speaking about that state specifically, but there can be sometimes the whoever the regulator is has to promulgate rules and regs, and that can take some period of time. And there may be other bases for ramp-ups. But listen, if you're in a state where there's a strong PBM law passed and you're a pharmacist, that's the time to start scrutinizing these claims and look for compliance and hop on it.
We've been doing that. We've been sending stuff in, and it's like, hey, if the PBM had a change, it would happen that first second. That's for
sure.
Lord
knows. But where they win, again, I say even when we win, we lose. So often where they win is enforcement and implementation. And that's all over the country. Some states have AGs or regulators who are more aggressive than others. But by and large, PBMs do really well there. And I always think about this, and I don't know if I've even said this to you before, but I remember my first year in law school, it was a torts class. And they were looking at a case where there was like an automobile manufacturer. And hey, we know X number of these cars are going to blow up. Out of those, X number are going to die. Out of those, X number are going to sue. We go to a jury. Let's do the math. Hey, we make money. Roll the cars out. And by fatigue, PBMs know that they can outlast pharmacists in terms of enforcement. You know, do you have all day to file MAC complaints on every single claim? No. And no pharmacist does. And so they know, hey, there's this MAC law in the state, but there'll be a rash of complaints early. Some will be investigated. Maybe we have to pay some out. We'll say, oops, our bad. But after 6 months, after a year, those complaints stop coming in and they roll.
It's kind of like I've always said that it doesn't make any sense for me to get 100% on a test because it means that I wasn't tested, that I put too much work into prep because maybe I would have gotten a 200%.
That's right.
With efficiencies, you always want to have some missing. That means that you studied or whatever the process is right up to about where you should have, but you didn't go over it. So I was just telling this to one of my team last week. I said, these PBMs and whoever, big companies, Google or anybody, they don't want to hit all the laws. If they're correct in all the laws, it means they're too particular. They're not aggressive enough and things like that. So I told him, I said, they want to maybe be 98% correct and pay fines on that 2% instead of having double the legal team they need or something. It's okay to miss a few. And I think they don't care. They're making plenty of money.
That's a really interesting perspective. And what I would say is because of their sheer size, even when they lose, they win. Because even if they pay, let's say they get caught steering and they pay a $1 million fine, but they made $100 million in that state steering for the year and getting drug maker discounts to their affiliated pharmacies through back channels, plus marking up prices on the drugs that they fill. Hey, cost of doing business. When you have their economies of scale, even when they get caught, unless somebody is just committed to absolutely throwing the book at them, it is not a deterrent to bad behavior.
No, and I think that I'm not making big corporations out to be evil, but I think that individual pharmacy owners or business owners, if they were to miss a law, they might take that personally. It might be, hey, it only cost me $1,000, but I don't like the fact that some people know about this, or I had to admit that I didn't get this law, things like that. And so there might be some personal angst about not hitting a law. The bigger corporations, it's a dollar sign and maybe a marketing sign, period, though.
Yes, I agree with you. And on top of pharmacists or small businesses taking it personally, they also don't have that economy of scale. So if they do get caught and they do get dinged, depending on what they're getting dinged for, it can be cost prohibitive. It can be something that in a worst case scenario could potentially close the doors of a business, jeopardize a state pharmacy license.
That's it.
When you're smaller, the stakes are higher.
There's no doubt about it.
Plus, pharmacists are community pharmacy owners, Main Street businesses, enjoy great reputations in their communities, and that means something to them too.
During COVID, there was certain things that I did not do at my pharmacy because I know I'm just a licensed business. And if for some reason the governor has something gnawing at them that they want to make a lesson of somebody, it's just a signature or a check mark away from your business being voided. The big boys, they can say, well, this law is obviously not going to bring us down as a corporation, but you're a small pharmacy and the governor thinks she's been pushed around and wants to kick the dog. Well, we might be the dog they're going to kick.
Yeah. And if you're a small business owner, that is not a place you want to be, particularly when you're the type of business that you know, the state holds your license in the palm of their hand, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Your comment on the PBMs shining up things the way they want to get past, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what are we talking about? The PBMs can bend laws and that kind of thing. It reminds me of one of my sons. I say to him, the teacher said that you threw an airplane across the room. Well, no, I didn't. She's a liar? No, but I didn't throw it across the room. I was on the right side of the room and I threw it towards the back of the room. So that was the same side. It wasn't across the room. All right. So you toss an airplane to the back of the room. No, you just said you did. No. So you're calling your teacher a liar. No, but it wasn't an airplane. I just crumbled it up. It didn't have any glide time at all. It was just a piece of paper I threw at somebody in the back of the room, that kind of thing. But they can go forever on that.
Hey, look, maybe a future lawyer there.
There you go.
For better or worse. You don't look too happy about that.
Yeah, that's right. All right, Greg, all of a sudden, for some reason, you are the only federal person that's on the legal team to make movement for pharmacy. For some reason, all the other legal pharmacists and associations and everything have gone away, and you're the guy. What do you do? Obviously, you need help, but what would be your own marching orders to say, all right, I'm going to start today and here's my step process to make this right?
Yeah. So forever, as long as we've been working on PBM reform, what I would say is we've been sitting at the table that the PBM set. And so we're always sort of trying to, and I'm sure you've heard this before, Mike, whack-a-mole. We're always trying to rein in these very specific, egregious practices, whatever that practice may be, whether it's a copay clawback, steering, network exclusion, whatever it is. I'm seeing a lot of just craziness on discount cards and how PBMs are not covering, but all of a sudden they're shifting the burden to the discount card and they're charging a patient this huge fee, or they're clawing back huge amounts of money from pharmacies percentage-wise. There's always a new game. So from my perspective, what I would love to see at the federal level is a law passed that it's really quite simple. PBMs are not setting drug prices. PBMs are not creating networks. And once you sort of go from there, and PBMs are not keeping rebates, and once you take away what I would say is those are like the big three legs that they stand on, then they can't arbitrage the price of a drug in the same way. And so what I would love to see is a law basically that says just that, and that has significant enforcement. When I say significant enforcement, I don't mean, hey, you're going to pay a penalty or a little fine here, a little fine there. We're talking about ultimately criminal culpability, similar to anti-kickback statutes or False Claims Act, things like that. But PBM should not be setting drug prices. We've seen enough. The jury is out. We talk about our little kid. It's time to take the ball away. We need to use an index-based pricing plus a fair dispensing fee plus find a way to compensate growth or increases in expenses for dispensing fees. But PBMs cannot be setting drug prices. PBMs absolutely should not be able to create networks, not a preferred network, not a broad network. They should not be doing that. And then, of course, they shouldn't be steering or engaging in any of those sort of self-interested transactions either. So day one, that's what I'd be looking to do. And that's a lot of what we advocate for. Now, you can go further than that. There's talk of, hey, let's break these folks up. Should they be owning? Should they be affiliated with an insurer or vice versa? No, they shouldn't. And so, but obviously, once you start talking about sort of deconstructing the system, that's a lot more significant. But what we know is when PBMs set drug prices, pharmacies lose, patients lose, taxpayers lose. It's not disputable. We've talked, APCI has worked with 3X's advisors on two big reports, drug pricing in Part D, and one, just disparities in drug pricing across market channels. And again, this is data-driven analysis. The jury is out. They cannot be setting drug prices. And similar with networks, when they're engaging in those network games, again, who's winning, who's losing? They're winning. They are the sole winner. Sometimes the plans, the health insurers who they're affiliated with as well. But that's what I'd be looking at. And then if I was at an agency perspective, let's say the FTC, and I think they've done a lot of good work. They're looking under the right rocks in terms of the 6B study, certainly. But I think that I'd love to see the FTC take some action ultimately beyond, hey, let's look at this and promulgate some regs. I think that their behavior is anti-competitive. I also think that much of it constitutes unfair methods of competition under Section 5 of the FTC Act. So put the hat on me and I'm at the FTC, that's what I'm looking at. If I'm over on the congressional side, what we were just talking about, again, passing legislation where their finger, the pen is out of their hand, the pencil is out of their hand, they're not setting prices, they're not creating networks. They've proven that they can't be trusted to do that.
Greg, the part about the networks, I'm trying to follow that. I know what they are, but when you have networks, then you have the monopolies because they're saying everybody has to do this. What do you mean by networks in this regard, and where is the danger of them?
So when I'm talking about networks, I'm talking about them creating pharmacy networks, or maybe broader insurers creating provider networks. So many games happen at the network level. But I'll give you an example. In Part D, you've got federal language that essentially says that a patient should get their choice of any willing provider. So what do? They've got these broad networks and they go and create preferred networks. Oh, wait a minute. The federal law doesn't touch these preferred networks. And what we've seen when states have gone to rein in steering, for example, and say, hey, PBM, you can't steer to your own pharmacy. You have to give the patient access to any pharmacy in that network. Well, they create a narrow network. It may be a 90-day network with only the mail order pharmacies are playing, or it may be a specialty network where all of a sudden pharmacies and oncologists can't dispense certain drugs for those patients anymore. It has to go to a mail order pharmacy. And again, what they say is, oh, no, no, we're not steering. That's just who's in the network. So networks are key to a lot of what they do. And of course, they also create preferred networks to, you know, drive down what they reimburse pharmacies if they let them into those preferred networks as well.
Let me see if I have this straight. It sounds like the network is a way to comply with the law by saying the patients and the corporations chose this. We have this other network that does all the stuff that you wanted. It's available. Is that sort of
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a fair way to couch it. And so often in the advocacy world, they'll do exactly what you just said. Oh, no, this is just an offering. Ultimately, it's the client that's going to select that. Of course, oftentimes the client is themselves because they own the insurer or they're owned by the insurer. So you definitely have that as well. But again, there are certain tools of the trade, and setting prices is one, creating networks is one. Also, the games they play with formularies and how they drive up list prices by demanding 30 to 40 to 50, sometimes 60% rebates on drugs and exclude others. It's what they do.
Greg, I heard this somewhere. This isn't mine, but some of the stuff you're talking about seems to remind me of like Visa and MasterCard, where they don't care so much what they're selling. They're not setting the price except for their fee. They really have more of a hands-off between the stores slash manufacturer, whatever, and the consumer. They're needed, but they're rather hands-off. Is that a close analogy at all?
I've never thought about it, but I think it could be. They're a conduit to essentially processing purchases, but they're not arbitraging the price of the product that person's buying. Yes, I think that's a fair way to couch that. Different. I've never thought about it, but it does make sense.
All right. So, Greg, you go in there and I'm going to ride shotgun with you as we go to Washington. It's going to be just you and I doing this whole thing for the whole nation. And I'm like, yeah, Greg, do it. This is great. All right. Now you're going to come up against people that are the naysayers of this. Who are the naysayers? I'm picturing PBM, lobbyists, paying tons of money to the legislators, and now you're dust.
I thought I was the only one left. Now all of a sudden the folks opposing it are back. This is the style. I don't like the direction
no,
of this one.
No, I just meant you're the only one fighting the good fight. You've got a you're Braveheart against this whole army over there. So no, I can't do that.
I thought I had the pen in my hand. Okay.
I'm just a lowly podcast host. If I'm going to make them fall down too, I need a raise on this. No, it's just our side that you're the only one doing it. Everybody else is still there.
Fair enough. I got carried away, but it was bliss for a second to even imagine it, Mike.
That's right.
So listen, you're going to have the usual suspects. You're going to have lobbyists for every one of the large pharmacy benefit managers, in-house government affairs folks for every one of the large pharmacy benefit managers. You're going to have the same for the insurers, contract lobbyists for them, then their national associations, their national groups, as the sun rises. But what they've done a really good job of, depending on what you're looking to go after, and particularly, I'd say, post-Rutledge v. PCMA, at the state level, what they've done a really good job of is getting employer groups and folks to be afraid of regulation. They think anything you pass, the sky is going to fall, premiums are going to go up, and benefits are going to be unaffordable. But PBMs and insurers are also always looking for allies at the federal level, folks, to help throw a wrench in or raise concerns. So, and then, of course, look, there's a lot of stakeholders beyond them. There is big money, Mike, in prescription drugs for almost everybody but community pharmacists and their community pharmacy-based organizations. If you look at the Fortune 10, the Fortune 20, boy, a lot of them are in the drug business. There's no doubt about it. It touches a lot of folks. And so what we see right now is there's over probably 50 bills federally dealing with pharmacy benefits managers, but very few of those are really looking to address and protect the interests of pharmacists. And so it just goes to show there are employer groups who want some PBM reform, but they want it at the federal level. They don't want it at the state level because they don't want to have to adhere to what they would say is a patchwork of different laws. They want PBMs to be reined in certain aspects that impact them, not the impact pharmacists, sometimes not the impact patients. There are, of course, patient groups. There are national chain groups. There's any number of interests, and everybody's going to want to have their say. And it's not just prescription drugs. I always say it's that one of the most fascinating things, whether it's state or federal, the number of interests and the number of issues that get brought up. If you're a congressperson at the federal level, or if you're a state rep or a state senator, depending on your district or your committee, I mean, you can't make up the number of issues. You've got banking issues, you've got IT issues, you've got social media issues, you've got pecan farmer issues, you've got chicken farmer issues, name it. The number of issues that pop up and then the number of different players who are impacted by any one issue, it's almost limitless. There are so many people that have what I would say voices on any one issue, but certainly in prescription drugs. And oftentimes there are folks who may have concerns about what you're advocating for, but sometimes there are people that surprise you, and there are alliances that can be made. And I think If you look, pharmacy has worked really well with patient groups, which is fantastic because so often what's good for community pharmacy turns out, hey, this is also good with patient. And so that's great work with oncology groups and other physician groups oftentimes because they also see firsthand, whether it's because of prior authorizations or whether it's because of steering, they see a lot of the games that pharmacy benefit managers play. And a group that we've been working with quite a bit, which I'm really pleased with, is a PBM group, believe it or not. It's called Transparency RX. It's a group of transparent, much smaller, transparent pharmacy benefits managers who are willing to kind of stand up and say, hey, these big PBM groups, they don't speak for us. And a lot of the things that they're saying is going to increase costs is in fact going to lower costs. And so what an awesome ally. And so community pharmacy isn't in it alone, but something that I am really concerned about is community pharmacy's voice, Mike, is not winning the day. I don't look at, hey, there's 50 plus PBM bills as a victory for community pharmacy. What are those bills going to do to keep doors open, to ensure that community pharmacy is there to care for their patients today, next month, and for years and years to come?
We talked about the heart that's in the business of community pharmacists. Coming to mind is like canary in a coal mine, but it's almost like you don't have that in pharmacy because even when our reimbursement goes down and people are actually getting paid below cost, the service is there still, basically. So it almost from the outside, it looks like independent pharmacy or community pharmacy is doing a great job. But then all of a sudden, the doors lock the next day. It's just a cliff because I think of pharmacists' heart and giving, and they don't slow down. They give and give until they figuratively die the next day, drop off the cliff. It's like there's not really a canary out there. And I think that communities are going to be hurt.
I could agree with you more that communities have been hurt. I've never really thought about it the way you just articulated it, but it's really interesting because if you're a patient walking into a pharmacy, you're getting the same level of care. Pharmacists are killing themselves in there. They're working hard. They're getting slaughtered on the reimbursement side. But outwardly facing, it's like, what is it you always hear about the swan? You can't see under the water all the work that's being done. So I think you're right. I don't think most patients probably have a clue the jeopardy that a lot of these community pharmacists, where they trade and where they go for care, the jeopardy that those stores are in. And then one day, you're right, right? There's a sign on the front door that shuttered.
Greg, I think I heard you on another show. You were saying that, I think your quote was something like this. Remember, none of these laws affect the reimbursement.
None of them are going to pay pharmacists fairly and transparently, period. And that's a pretty big deal. And that's really something that should be front and center to any true PBM reform. And again, it's not just that it's going to help community pharmacists. It's going to help the system. It's going to help the patients. It's going to help the taxpayers. Because while PBMs are setting those drug prices and arbitraging those drug prices, it's all made up and it's all rigged. And something, I don't remember if you and I have talked about this before, but pharmacy obviously was hammering DIR fees forever, for years and years, from 2014 up until this year. And certainly pharmacy address the issues from the perspective of, hey, how do you run a business when we're getting this money retroactively recouped? And certainly it harmed pharmacy, but it also harmed patients because so much of what DIR fees were about was denying patients the benefit of the, quote, pharmacy discounts at the point of sale. And so if the PBM knows we're going to pay the pharmacy 70 at the end of the day, but they charge the patient a deductible or cost share based on the 100, they're subsidizing that plan. They're subsidizing their profits that way. And so the fix, the quote DIR fix, is going to now ensure, hopefully, that patients are not being overcharged, that their cost shares at the point of sale are based on the lowest possible reimbursement. But the pharmacist reimbursement still hasn't been addressed, right? And I think what we're seeing now is, arguably, it's worse.
Greg, what would wording look like that hits on the price? I know some Medicaids say they're going to do this plus $11, $12, something like that. I know that some people talk about not having something below cost and NADAC this and that. And your best guess, what would a pricing thing look like? How would you word that? And how would that actually have teeth to it that can't be moved around like you see the PBMs doing stuff now?
Well, not easily. There's not necessarily a panacea, but I'm a big believer in if you move to an index-based model, that's a great place to start. And so if you say that reimbursement can't be below, or maybe even above, but can't be below the national average drug acquisition cost plus a dispensing fee, and you can have a set dispensing fee, you can tie it to state surveys via CMS Medicaid program. There's different ways to do it. But here's what I would say, and it doesn't have to be NADAC. There could be something ultimately better out there. Alabama average acquisition cost is a really robust database, and we find there's a lot of drugs that are on the AAC that aren't even necessarily on that. But if you move to an index-based model so that the price of the drug is the same as to the pharmacy, as to the patient, as to the plan, as to the taxpayer, and that price isn't getting arbitraged, it's a fantastic place to start, plus a fair dispensing fee. And then obviously you have to say that there can't be any point of sale or retroactive adjustments or recoupments that would in any way, shape, or form impact that reimbursement to a pharmacy. But I think that's a great place to start. And once the system is no longer broken and everybody's operating off of the same drug price, well, then there's always work to do. Maybe NADAC can be strengthened. Maybe that can be made better. And there are some bills that look to do that. Maybe it's the dispensing fee. There's work to be done on increasing the dispensing fee. Or maybe there's NADAC plus dispensing fee plus some other percentage. And so there's different ways to do it. But as long as we're sitting at a table where the PBM sets the price, we've lost the game.
Is there any categories in business that have done that, that set prices like pharmacy would in a panacea?
Well, I guess I'd push back on that this is setting prices. What I would say is this is market-based pricing. This is ensuring that the index is going to reflect the market. And what I would argue, most industries' prices reflect the market. Very rarely is there an industry where you have a player like the PBM who's manipulating the price at every level. And again, there are circumstances when they're at their best. And when I say at their best, I mean their worst, where the same drug on the same day, and their most recent three-axis report identifies it. Same drug, same day, five different prices, seven different prices at the same pharmacy for the same drug on the same day by the same PBM. It's literally made up. And so we are in what I would argue is really a rigged market. It is not a free market. It's not that the actual market prices are reflecting what patients are paying and what pharmacies are being reimbursed. And so by moving to an index-based pricing, ultimately what we're trying to get to is getting the price of the drug to reflect what the actual market price is versus a made-up price that's behind some trade-secreted methodology that nobody can figure out. And again, there are times where the pharmacy's reimbursed. And I mean, let's just walk through it. And this will be off the top of my head here. But think about it. There are times where a PBM may mandate a brand name drug. There's a generic that's available for $100 less, for $200 less, but they mandate that brand. The patient is in the deductible phase. So let's say it's a $100 drug, the brand name drug. Let's say they could have got a generic for $30. The patient pays the $100 for the brand name drug. The PBM comes nothing out of pocket. Let's say the PBM claws back $20 from the pharmacy, and then the PBM gets a 30% from the drug manufacturer. The PBM is paid out nothing. PBM gets $30 from the drug maker. The PBM gets $20 from the pharmacy. And the patient overpaid. They overpaid by $30 because they didn't get the benefit of the rebate. And then they could have gotten a cheaper generic on top of it. They're not paying anything out of pocket, and they have rigged the drug price so they get paid from the pharmacy, from the patient, as well as from the drug manufacturer.
And they're the only ones that didn't physically touch that bottle.
Right. They didn't touch it. They didn't make it. They adjudicated a claim, and they overcharged everybody.
Greg, I'm going to push back still. I like the index thing. It's not a price fixing or whatever. It's just like everybody's got to play by these rules. Is there a business sector that does this? Or could you argue that, no, it doesn't, but the PBMs are worse than any business sectors, and so this is going to be the first one?
This is off the cuff, but interest rates.
I was just going to mention that because I got a loan the other day, and it was home equity. It was like, all right, what is it going to be off of prime? which is 8.5% now. Is it going to be a little bit above it, a little bit below it? But everybody's working off of that, and everybody knows there's got to be money built into the loans or else the banks aren't going to be there.
Yeah, for sure. And then, of course, there are commodities and you've got markets that track them, and you've got index funds where billions of dollars are traded day in, day out. So I think there's lots of precedent for indexes.
And everybody can see it.
Everybody can see it. And that's absolutely right. So that's what I would say. And again, there are things that make pharmacy unique, to be sure. But the other thing I would say is that pharmacy itself is where the precedent is, because this is working. And obviously, you're deep in the pharmacy business and you have these conversations a lot yourself. But in Medicaid fee-for-service, most states are paying based off of NADAC plus a dispensing fee. Is it perfect? I would say not. And there are issues, certainly. But that's where the least amount of problems are, right? The state isn't overpaying for the drugs. The pharmacies, by and large, are getting paid somewhat fairly. So the index model is not non-existent. It's not like something out of nothing. This is a model that was created, and I'll probably get the year wrong here, somewhere between 2010 and 2012, because there were so many games with drug pricing and Medicaid fee-for-service programs.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's working. I very rarely hear complaints coming from Medicaid fee-for-service. Now, Medicaid managed care are very different because they get paid via capitated model, PBMs, and they do whatever they want with the drug price. But a transparent index has proven to work far more efficiently and been far fairer for all parties involved in pharmacy already than the current MAC model, if you will.
Greg, if you had to take both sides of a debate, and yes, there is an opposing side on this one. I'm telling you that right up front.
Yeah.
Let's say that you've got somebody who says, nothing is going to change. I've heard this forever, the national associations and this and that. And someone else says, there's movement. There is movement. What bullet points would the naysayer have to prove no movement? And what bullet points would the pro-association have to at least put metrics on some unit? One metric might be, well, there's 55 laws in the legislation right now, and years ago there was only 10. But then this side might say, years ago there was 30 PBMs, and they split the market at 4% apiece, and now the top three have 80 or something. What metrics could you put on both sides if you had to make that argument both ways?
Yeah. So, which one do you want me to start with?
Well, let's start with the negative, and let's say how things have been the same or gotten worse through the years.
Sure. I think the argument would be pharmacy's been at this a long time. Right. And Mike, behind me, I don't think you can see it, but on my bookcase, there's a VHS cassette that says PBMs 101. A VHS cassette with a community pharmacist were using to inform their congresspeople about PBMs back when VHS cassette was in. That's how folks watch things. But for all of that advocacy and for all of those efforts, the payment model hasn't been addressed and it hasn't been fixed. And as a matter of fact, there's really never been even a bill introduced that would truly address the reimbursement model for pharmacy at the federal level. And in most states as well. States have passed MAC pricing laws. There have been MAC laws introduced at the federal level as well. But at the end of the day, pharmacy reimbursement remains a problem, and it's a problem that gets worse and worse, not better and better, after all of those years of advocacy. When I have conversations with pharmacists who are really frustrated, I would say that's what I hear the most. Now, the flip side, and I would say this is the side that I believe, someday history will look back on this war that I would say, this political war between community pharmacy and the biggest companies on earth, these pharmacy benefit managers. And it will tell an interesting tale because community pharmacists are Main Street businesses. And here they are, where so many other Main Street businesses have disappeared. Go find a corner hardware store. Go find a video store while we're talking about VHS cassettes, right? Pharmacists are here and they're caring for their patients and they're innovating and they're widely recognized as being central to healthcare in this country in many ways, metropolitan areas as well as rural areas. And what I would say is I would be hard-pressed, I can certainly tell you in Georgia, but nationwide, I would be hard-pressed to find a group at the state level who have had the legislative success that pharmacy has had. I can't think of another group that frankly even comes close against not nobody. And I always say this, Mike, it's hard to pass any bill. It's hard to pass an uncontroversial bill. Pass a bill that says it's legal to pet puppies, and it's hard to get that bill passed. And pharmacists time and time again across the country have been able to pass massive legislation in the last 5-6 years against tremendous odds. In most states, you have maybe a state pharmacy association lobbyist, maybe a little help from a buying group or two, and maybe a patient group, and you're up against 40, 50 contract lobbyists on the other side. But community pharmacy has won. And that's a big deal. Have we fixed reimbursement? No, not necessarily, although you've seen pockets where things have been really different. West Virginia has the NADAC plus dispensing fee. Tennessee has something similar. Ohio's done a lot in their Medicaid program. In Georgia, as a result of advocacy of the Georgia Pharmacy Association and APCI, proud to say community pharmacists and Medicaid managed care get paid 1063 dispensing fee for every claim. So it went from 8 cents, 13 cents to 1063 as a direct result of community pharmacy advocacy. And so across the country, community pharmacy has won some major victories, whether it's copay clawbacks, whether it's transaction fees, whether it's MAC laws, which largely have failed. And I've been a part of writing some of those, not ashamed to say, a lot of those have failed. And in certain cases, steering and reimbursement as well. So there's a lot of wins. And I'll tell you something else. There's not a lot of industries that can boast taking an issue all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court and getting a victory there too, because that's pretty improbable in and of itself. And now you've got an issue at the federal level, and I credit community pharmacy for the bulk of this, but there is an environment where PBMs are on the menu. There's over 50 bills that are looking to address PBMs. And so there pharmacists are behind the counter, they're getting beat up. This January, I would say, it sounds like it's probably the worst January pharmacies maybe ever had. And I'm not the one taking those punches behind the counter. But what I can tell you is, with a little bit of perspective and when there's time to look up and look, there are a lot of really amazing things going on. This is a very unique time, and I think pharmacy will find ways to keep winning. But again, I am worried that in this climate where you have 50 plus bills dealing with PBMs, there isn't a community pharmacy bill out there that's going to ensure that those stores stay open so that they can continue caring for their patients wherever those patients in those stores may be.
And that concern basically is a dollar sign, because it seems like we have ability to care, being allowed to serve the patient, but at what you'd consider a fair price. And that's what you're alluding to there, that there's nothing there right now that's going to keep those open.
Yeah, that's right. But what I would say is paying pharmacists fairly isn't synonymous with increasing costs to the system, because it's not. Because we've seen when states have carved out prescription drug benefits from Medicaid managed care companies and moved to fee-for-service, which is NADAC plus dispensing fee based, what we see is millions and millions, sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars in savings. So you can pay pharmacists fairly and still have savings to the system, sometimes massive savings to the system and massive savings to patients. And so I think it's really important. I hate to see pharmacists get self-conscious to talk about reimbursement, because it's a fair conversation. It's not just about reimbursement. It's about a lot of things, but reimbursement is a really important part of it. But you can pay pharmacists fairly without increasing costs to the system. And I think that's an important point that has to be drawn out anytime you're having these conversations.
And Greg, you and I just touched on it earlier. We talked about the brand name, which was 100 versus 30. And we talked about the manufacturer and the patient and the pharmacy, and the person that made the bulk of this profit didn't touch the medicine, didn't touch the bottle, being the PBM. And yep. So decrease that, put some pride back in the profession, and pay the pharmacist more, and everybody's going to be happy maybe at having $70 in the system versus $100 in the system, something like that. A lot can happen with just shortening the pockets of the PBMs a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. They are in the middle and they are feeding off of everybody. And when you cut those practices out, plenty of room to pay pharmacists fairly and still save patients, taxpayers, and employers money.
Well, Greg, golly, nice to see you again. It's always fun to talk about our war against the other side. And I'm sorry I didn't let you know that the other side still had all of their weapons pointed at us and you were the only guy on our side. But now you get to go to bed tonight just being thankful that it's not just you.
Hey, that's right.
There's a bright side.
Look, I got carried away with the analogy, but it's always a pleasure talking with you and love to talk about this stuff and appreciate everything that you do and the spotlight that you shine on these issues. But if I could leave folks with one thing, it's this is not a time to let the foot off the gas. Again, I'm right there with you. There are times where I feel cynical and feel like we're Don Quixote chasing windmills. But this is the time to apply pressure. Pressure bust pipes. And you got over 50 bills. Things are hot at the state level. And this is a time for all community pharmacists to get involved and push, 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 because there's real chances to get meaningful reform. And I enjoy talking about them with you.
Well, you're a busy guy, Greg, with a lot on your plate. And I appreciate you carving out time for us. Thanks again.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Please subscribe for all future episodes.